Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, July 15th, 2026, we are delighted to host a discussion entitled Litigation Update, Minnesota Telecom Alliance versus FCC. My name is Lily Freemeyer, and I am a rising 2L at Washington and Lee University Law School, serving as student liaison to the Communications Technology Practice Group Executive Committee at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, I will keep the introductions brief, but if you would like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have Dr. Christopher Alley, Jennifer B. Dickey, and Daniel H. Kahn as our speakers and Matthew Furlow as our moderator. Dr. Alley is the Pioneers Chair in Telecommunications at Penn State University. Ms. Dickey is the Vice President and Deputy Chief Counsel of the U.S. Chamber Litigation Center at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And Mr. Kahn is a partner at Wilkinson Barker Knauer LLP. And Mr. Furlow serves as counsel for the U.S. House Committee on Energy and Commerce. One last note, throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature in Zoom so that we will have access to them for that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today. Mr. Furlow, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Lily, and thank you for all the panelists for kind of being here today. Before kind of diving into the questions, I want to provide just a very brief overview of the issue. In 2021, Congress enacted the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, which was a major surface telecom energy investment legislation. Within that legislation included Section 6506, which directed the Federal Communications Commission to issue rules to prevent digital discrimination access, broadband deployment and service. The FCC issued a final order in 2023. And in doing so, the FCC opted to pursue a disparate impact framework to address digital discrimination. As a result, numerous industry groups filed lawsuits against the order, and ultimately the Eighth Circuit took up the case. But before we go into the case and kind of and some of the litigation details, I kind of want to start a little bit more high level and with kind of the legislative and regulatory background. Chris, could you kind of provide some additional background on, you know, what is digital discrimination, why it's important, and why did policymakers really kind of enact this section?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for the question, Matt. And thank you to FedSoc for inviting me to be on this panel today. It's really exciting. A great way to spend a July afternoon. So a little bit of background that led to Congress's decision. A couple of things that we need to remember is that broadband is not a utility here in the United States, and therefore not subject to many of the universal service provisions or rate regulation provisions as other basic utilities. The universal service mandate has been rather inconsistently applied, and broadband has become largely a market failure in many communities across the country. During the pandemic, for instance, we saw a huge gap in availability and affordability of broadband. One study, for instance, said that upwards of 42 million Americans did not have access to the internet during the pandemic. Lots of studies have also reported that low-income neighborhoods and neighborhoods with predominantly people of color have slower broadband speeds and sometimes more expensive broadband subscriptions than neighboring wealthy communities. And studies have shown that this has been the case in cities like Cleveland and Detroit, Kansas City, New York, and certain areas of California. And this has largely been known as digital redlining, which echoes the kind of housing redlining of decades past. So the digital discrimination orders were passed as a package of measures taken by Congress, as Matt said, in the 2021 Infrastructure Act to address the wider issue of digital equity and inclusion, or rather the lack of digital equity and inclusion here in the United States. space. And just as a little bit of background, we can think about digital equity inclusion as connectivity plus everything else. The recognition that connectivity alone will not bring people forward to the internet, will not make us a digitally savvy community of neighbors. Instead, we need programs like affordability programs. We need skill development. We need device access, for instance. And all of this would fall under the larger umbrella of digital equity and inclusion, as does digital discrimination. So along with this, this order came, for instance, the Affordable Connectivity Program, which was a $14 billion program to offset broadband to low-income households. And just as a little kind of footnote here, we in the United States pay the most for broadband monthly than anywhere else in the OECD. We also in the Infrastructure Act had the $2.75 billion funding programs through the Digital Equity Act. As an example around affordability, over 50 million households qualify for the Affordable Connectivity Program and over 23 million subscribed. And as a point of reference, there are only 133 million households in the United States. So suggesting that one third of American households qualified for the Affordable Connectivity Program. So in combination, these efforts were kind of meant to quell digital discrimination and build an ecosystem of digital equity and inclusion in the country.
Thank you, Chris. And kind of let's dive a little bit deeper on Section 6506. Can you kind of walk us through what did that section actually direct the FCC to do, and what were some of the key provisions?
For sure. Yeah. So the FCC was ordered to take steps to ensure equal access to broadband throughout the country. And it's important to think about this kind of equal access or equal service kind of phrase there. They were to create rules preventing digital discrimination of access relating to income, race, ethnicity, color, religion, or national origin. They were mandated to identify steps also to eliminate digital discrimination. So we have these two provisions, right? Preventing discrimination on one hand and eliminating existing discrimination on the other hand. This is all in service to the facilitation of equal access to broadband internet services. And I'm just going to actually define, or I'm going to read how the statute defines equal service. Equal service is defined as, quote, the equal opportunity to subscribe to an offered service that provides comparable speeds, capacities, latency, and other quality of service metrics in a given area for comparable terms and conditions, end quote. So again, that's what we're doing this in service to. There is a pretty large caveat with all of this, is that the FCC had to take into account, quote, technical and economic feasibility. So it wasn't just that the FCC could propose these rules, but if a company could justify their actions based on technical or economic feasibility, then they were considered not to have done digital discrimination. The FCC was also ordered to develop model policies and best practices for states and localities. It was ordered to revise its public complaint process to accept complaints from the public directly related to digital discrimination. But first of all, to do all of this, the FCC had to, of course, define digital discrimination, which was never actually defined in the statute. And you want me to go ahead and I can also just read how the FCC defined it just to get us started here. So again, this is a direct quote for everyone listening or watching here. So digital discrimination of access, according to the Federal Communications Commission, is defined as policies or practices not justified by genuine issues of technical or economic feasibility that differentially impact consumers' access to broadband internet access service based on their income level, race, ethnicity, color, religion, or national origin, or are intended to have such differential impact, end quote.
Thank you, Chris. And now that we're at the kind of the FCC's consideration of the rule, Dan, can you kind of walk us through how the FCC tackled some of these, you know, statutory ambiguities, and what were some of the key points of kind of contention in the docket?
Of course. Thanks, Matt. So the FCC began its proceeding to implement this statute with what it calls a notice of inquiry, which is a wide open series of questions, not a lot of concrete rulemaking proposals, essentially asking, what should we do with this? And then it took that record and issued a notice of proposed rulemaking, which is a much more concrete set of proposals of, here are all of the steps we're proposing to take. The notice of inquiry is often a sign that the agency isn't really sure what to do in the first place, which perhaps isn't a surprise given the
the newness of the statute. It's a pretty short statute and doesn't have any legislative history that really informs its meaning. And we saw over the course of those initial filing periods, I'd say, a whole series of issues being debated that I think started with two different worldviews, and Chris gave one of them really well. I'll just articulate the other one, which I advocated for on behalf of my clients, which is that we are, and it's a very different, and in my view, at least more optimistic viewpoint, that we're in a kind of unprecedented age of broadband expansion and affordability. Even as there's been a lot of inflation across the entire economy, broadband prices have been going down, and that's because of competition and the deregulated environment that Chris mentioned. In comparison to Europe, people like to debate these, but I think the pandemic really stands out as a great example of, during the pandemic, several European nations had to ask their broadband providers to intentionally slow down services like Netflix so that people could access essential content. And we didn't see anything like that in this country, which spoke, I think, to the robustness of the broadband networks. And they've only gotten better from there with the advent of new services like 5G Home and low Earth orbit satellite service. So turning back to the rulemaking, we had a very robust debate about, is this, starting with the viewpoint that I articulated, a narrow statute that provides a backstop in the context of a statute that's enacting huge and unprecedented funding programs like BEAD, which is allocated $42.5 billion for broadband deployment for the affordable connectivity program, I'm sorry, that Chris mentioned, and there was a digital equity grant program as well. Is this a backstop that prevents targeted forms of discrimination, or is it more of a transformation of the relationship between the FCC and the broadband market, which I think is the other viewpoint that came about in part because of some of the criticisms that Chris mentioned. And this had a lot of different axes. The biggest and most prominent, and one that the court ultimately addressed, was, is this a statute addressed only specifically to disparate treatment or intentional discrimination, or does it also encompass disparate impact, meaning essentially unintentional discrimination? But that wasn't really the only big issue. There was also a big question about the scope of who's regulated, whether it's just broadband providers or, as the FCC ultimately concluded, anyone who affects broadband. Is the scope of what exactly is regulated? Is it just deployment? Is it a lot more than that? Again, that's what the FCC ultimately concluded. How should the complaint process be structured? And that had a lot of different, that was pretty multi-axis, I would say. There were a lot of different perspectives on that. And what sort of penalties are available? Are the penalties that the FCC can apply under the Communications Act available, or by situating the statute outside of the Communications Act, did Congress carve those out? I don't know if you want me to talk about where the FCC came out on all this as well, or
Maybe especially kind of walking through how the FCC came out on the disparate impact versus disparate treatment issue.
Sure, of course. The FCC took what I at least personally view as a fairly maximalist approach in the final order. It concluded that there was no evidence of intentional discrimination in the broadband industry, and one might conceive of that as a positive finding that might mitigate toward a more narrow approach, but that's not the direction the FCC went. It concluded that was a basis for pivoting mainly to disparate impact liability. And the FCC developed at least what to me reads as its own kind of bespoke disparate impact standard that it doesn't really follow the standard that the Supreme Court had articulated in the Inclusive Communities case around the Fair Housing Act and some of the other statutes that are subject to a disparate impact standard. Under the FCC's test, I don't need to repeat it since Chris articulated it, but anyone who impacts broadband deployment has to essentially consider weigh technical and economic feasibility as with particular reference to their competitors. And if something, essentially, if something is, and again, it was not the clearest articulated test. But if something was technically or economically feasible, then the provider had, with reference to the specific protected groups articulated in the statute, then the provider or whatever other regulated entity would have to seriously consider taking that step and potentially take that step. The FCC didn't limit this to deployment, but rather applied it to anything that has to do with the broadband market, any providers in the broadband market. And it concluded that it could apply any sort of penalty that it ordinarily applies. And just to wrap it up, the FCC also indicated that wasn't the end of the story. At the time, it had a further notice of proposed rulemaking that proposed moving from substantive compliance to procedures for compliance with proposals around required internal reporting mechanisms structures for how to measure compliance and various reporting requirements.
Thank you, Dan. I think maybe before we get to the litigation, I would like to dive a little bit deeper on the actual kind of impact, either intended or on disparate impact versus disparate treatment. Dan, how in practice would a disparate impact liability standard impact a broadband provider's deployment decisions? How would that work in practice? Then after that, Chris, I'd love to kind of understand your perspective as well.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. It's a great question and a very hard question that the industry, as you can imagine, was grappling with in the wake of this order. And I do think it's important to have two clarifications off the bat. The first is just to reiterate, as I mentioned, it's not just deployment that the FCC purported to regulate, but everything, including things like advertising and discounts. And I also just want to repeat the point I made before about how we're not just talking about a kind of hypothetical disparate impact standard, but rather the specific kind of customized disparate impact standard that the FCC articulated. But applying that in the context of, frankly, pretty much any business decision around broadband, a provider or other entity would have been hard to escape considering publicly available demographic data about the areas where it's considering deploying or whatever the other action is, and then weigh taking that action in a way that's balanced with respect to the specific factors identified in the statute. In my view, that would require, if we're talking about deployment, for instance, that would result in less deployment overall, since deployment wouldn't be based solely on cost or demand or maximizing profit that could then be invested in future deployment in future years. Those in favor of a disparate impact standard presumably would argue that's worth the trade-off. It also would, I think, even before the FCC was going to require various procedural compliance mechanisms, establishing a lot of internal mechanisms to track how these decisions are being made, because I think in an investigation that would have been a lot of the evidence of compliance likely brought forward, partly because the requirements were pretty nebulous. In my view, it ultimately meant you needed to always be prepared to tell a story about what you're doing and explain it.
Thank you for that. Chris, would you like to kind of jump in at all on that?
Yeah, just to provide maybe two examples that were kind of major talking points in the comments to this. One was, of course, the deployment of technology, right? So if you had, if you were an ISP, broadband internet provider, providing fiber optics to one area versus fixed wireless to another area, right? And those, which are two different technologies, which means you get two different upload and download speeds, different set of latency, or one of those directed towards a covered population. And then you'd have to have that kind of technical or economic justification. We have seen this happen repeatedly, right? Particularly with low-income areas where a different technology, usually a subpar technology, is deployed in those areas. The other thing that was a major fight here amongst commentators towards the FCC docket was around price and pricing, right? Should price be included as the potential for discriminatory behavior? And again, we have seen examples, and I think everyone could point to an example of how they're paying a different set of prices than maybe their neighbor is paying a different set of prices, or the community across the street is paying. And the question then becomes, how does that look when we add in these demographic factors, as Dan mentioned? And are we seeing kind of systemic or systematic price differentials between, for instance, a wealthy neighborhood and a low-income neighborhood? And there have been some documented cases of this as well. And again, it kind of all feeds into this concern, particularly from the public interest and academic community, around digital redlining and whether or not providers are kind of mimicking the redlining that happened in housing, in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s.
Thank you. So let's kind of turn to the case. Jen, I know the chamber, along with state and local chambers, filed extensive comments to the docket, both the NOI and PRM stage. Can you kind of outline first some of the chamber's key concerns with what the FCC ultimately issued, and then also some of the primary arguments that the chamber outlined against the legality of the rule?
Sure. So on the policy side, the U.S. chamber was, I think, a little bit closer to where Dan is in terms of like optimistic. We are supportive of closing the digital divide. We view the private sector as having really led the charge in investing billions of dollars to build out networks and make other improvements that have made internet connectivity more affordable and more accessible to Americans. So like just as of 2009, about a third of Americans did not have broadband. But by the end of 2019, approximately 96% of Americans had access to broadband at home. Nevertheless, some Americans still don't have broadband. And that could be either because they live in remote rural communities where the per unit costs of deploying internet infrastructure are high and the investment's just not financially justifiable for the internet service providers, or because the Americans choose not to purchase broadband for economic or other reasons. So for example, someone might say, I have cell service with internet on my phone. I'm not going to pay for broadband separately because I don't like that's too expensive. Or they might say, I just prefer not to have internet in my home. But still, you know, the chamber is generally supportive of efforts to close the digital divide. And we were concerned that the digital discrimination rule was actually going to harm that the record didn't support the claim that there was actually any intentional discrimination going on, and that disparate impact liability would actually open the door to second guessing deployment decisions. And that would lead to, you know, deployment, like chilling of new deployments, because companies would have to shift their resources from investing in the deployment and in research and development to regulatory and legal compliance. So we argued that the commission should focus on other barriers to broadband deployment, such as, you know, the expiration of funds for the Affordable Connectivity Program, or reducing permitting barriers to deployment. That was kind of like the policy argument from the chamber side. And then in terms of the legal side, we argued that the statute just simply did not authorize the FCC to impose disparate impact liability or some of the broad enforcement mechanisms that the commission was envisioning. And I guess shifting to sort of the litigation, once the rule was finalized, we filed a petition for review. Petitions for review are like typically very bare bones. And then you see all the arguments actually once like the opening brief is filed. And there's a lot of rigmarole before you get to an opening brief, because the FCC has like a judicial lottery statute, but there were a bunch of petitions filed. We all ended up consolidated in front of the Eighth Circuit. And when the chamber filed its opening brief, we made five claims. The first is the one I sort of already previewed, which is like the big one. The commission lacks statutory authority to impose disparate impact liability because Section 60506 only authorizes disparate treatment liability. So only when you're intending to discriminate, not when there's disparate impact, sort of disparate effects based on a protected characteristic. Number two, we said that the commission lacked its statutory authority for the novel burden shifting framework that it adopted, where basically if the FCC found that a covered entity's policies or practices were intentionally discriminatory or having discriminatory effects, the defendant was supposed to demonstrate that the policy was justified by genuine issues of technical or economic feasibility. And the rule noted that that could include proof that there that available less discriminatory alternatives were not reasonably achievable at the time the policy or practice was adopted. But that approach is different from the ordinary rule that the defendant just has to come forward with any substantial, legitimate, non-discriminatory interest in support of its policy. And then ordinarily the burden would shift back to the plaintiff to identify a less discriminatory alternative that is equally effective. So we were basically saying you should have followed the normal burden shifting framework for disparate impact. And then our third argument was that the commission lacked statutory authority to regulate entities other than internet service providers, which Dan mentioned. You know, the FCC took a very maximalist view on who could potentially be covered by the disparate impact liability. Our fourth argument was that the commission lacked statutory authority for the full suite of enforcement mechanisms it claimed, including the possibility of monetary remedies. And so this argument is like fairly simple. Basically, we said, normally, the commission's enforcement mechanisms come from the Communications Act, but Congress chose not to incorporate Section 60506 into the Communications Act. So then you just have to rely on other implied remedies. And our argument was that Section 60506 is very forward-looking, like prevent discrimination, eliminate, you know, discrimination. And those forward-looking remedies would not include monetary, backward-looking sort of monetary relief. It would really be like things like cease and desist orders. And our fifth argument was that the order was arbitrary and capricious for failing to justify its departure from the standard burden-shifting framework, and also for failing to consider the full costs on, especially on like non-ISPs who would be covered, and to justify that sort of broad coverage. So those are the five arguments that we brought and that the industry brought sort of in general.
Thank you, Jenna. Kind of sticking with you for a moment, you briefly kind of discussed this burden shifting framework. Can you kind of go a little deeper on how courts and other and statutes have addressed discriminatory treatment versus disparate impact?
Sure. So disparate impact liability really got its like imprimatur from the Supreme Court in a 1971 case called Griggs versus Duke Power Company. And that was where the court interpreted Title VII's language about depriving any individual of employment opportunities or otherwise adversely affecting his status as an employee to create disparate impact liability, because that otherwise adversely affect language focused on the consequences of employment practices, not simply the motivation. And so the court said they're focused on the consequences. It doesn't really matter why you did it. If it's like discriminatory effect, you might be on the hook. Then in Smith versus City of Jackson, which was in 2005, a plurality of the court reached a similar conclusion under the ADEA. There was again that otherwise adversely affect language. And then a decade later in Inclusive Communities in 2015, the Supreme Court held that the Fair Housing Act authorized disparate impact liability. And there, the otherwise adversely affect language was not in the operative provision, but it was in a nearby provision. And where it said it had language about otherwise making unavailable or denying a dwelling to any person. And there were also some subsequent statutory amendments and legislative history that the court thought suggested Congress intended that to have disparate impact liability. But Inclusive Communities is a really interesting decision because the court there was really grappling with what I think is a philosophical debate underlying disparate impact. Like, is disparate impact liability an effort to just eliminate differences in terms of how protected characteristics, like protected characteristics, like have effects? So like eliminate any racially discriminatory effects? Or is it really about like smoking out intentional discrimination, where we think there's something underlying the decision that we can't really point out? Like, there's someone didn't say I'm doing this because of your characteristic, but there's a lot of smoke that suggests there's fire of intentional discrimination. And you see kind of both trends, I think, in Inclusive Communities. Like, on the one hand, the majority talks about the vestiges of de jure discrimination that are still alive in housing today, and talked about, you know, flight from the cities and how racially polarized housing is like really a vestige of those official things. And that sounds like they just want to get rid of, you know, those vestiges, which, you know, is a laudable goal. But then you also have them say, disparate impact liability must be limited so employers and other regulated entities are able to make the practical business choices and profit-related decisions that sustain a vibrant and dynamic free enterprise system, which does not sound in eliminating vestiges, but sounds more in like, we want to make sure we're not being unduly, we're not putting too much pressure on businesses. They still need freedom to act if, as long as there's like legitimate, you know, business decisions going on. So it, you had that tension in the opinion. And what the court ended up doing is it announced several guardrails about how disparate impact liability should be imposed. So for example, it said you can't just rely on a statistical disparity. You have to find that the there's like a strict, robust causality requirement that you have to show evidence that it's the policy or practice of the defendant that's causing that differential impact, not just like something that existed in society generally that they're kind of being held on the hook for. And then, you know, the burden shifts to the defendant to prove that the challenged practice is necessary to achieve one or more substantial, legitimate, non-discriminatory interests. That's like trying to, again, smoke out discriminatory intent. And then finally, if the defendant identifies such an interest, the burden shifts back to the plaintiff, who can only prevail upon showing that there's a substantial, showing that the same substantial, legitimate, non-discriminatory interest could be served by another practice that has a less discriminatory effect. And there, again, you're kind of looking at like, well, if you could avoid the discriminatory impact but equally serve that interest, why wouldn't you? Like, that seems like, again, maybe like you're trying to smoke out intentional discrimination. And the court said this whole framework was necessary to protect potential defendants against abusive disparate impact claims. And then, so in the last 10 years, the court has not found a new disparate impact regime. So while lower courts after Griggs have been, they were much more open to finding disparate impact liability in statutes, and the agencies were too. You saw agencies interpreting their statutes to have disparate impact liability. I think there's been a noticeable turn away from that framework since inclusive communities. And of course, now the Trump administration is adjusting its regulations and litigating positions to oppose reading such liability into federal statutes and to strictly limit it when it's there. So that's kind of the philosophical debate that was underlying it and where we're at right now.
Thank you. Very detailed overview. Very, very, very helpful. So kind of given this background and framework, Dan, how did the Eighth Circuit eventually come to their decision? And what were their key holdings?
Sure. And it took them a while to do it because the case was with them for almost 2 years, but it came out for that a pretty, I think, straightforward, clear opinion, largely based on Loper-Bright. With respect to disparate impact, the court concluded that the statute did not authorize a disparate impact standard. It looked at a few things. It looked at the cases that Jennifer mentioned where the Supreme Court specifically did find disparate impact liability, and they all had that similar structure with the catch-all language at the end that didn't look at intent and used the word otherwise in a special formulation that signified a shift to disparate impact. As Chris mentioned in the beginning, the digital discrimination statute doesn't have that framework. Instead, it says the FCC is supposed to prevent digital discrimination of access based on income level, race, ethnicity, color, religion, or national origin. And the court looked at that based on language and interpreted it according to its plain meaning of because of, meaning discrimination because of a particular characteristic, which the court concluded based on precedent points to intentional discrimination. It looked at various counterarguments, including particularly the idea that feasibility isn't compatible with an intentional discrimination standard. And the court pointed out, rightly, that feasibility can be relevant to indirect evidence in an intentional discrimination case. Turning from the disparate treatment versus disparate impact issue to the covered entities issue, the court also concluded that the statute can only be understood to regulate broadband providers. and not anybody else. And again, the court focused pretty closely on the statute's text and noted that it only really refers to two parties in the context of the provision of broadband service, the subscribers and the providers. It also looked to the statement of policy that declares that subscribers should benefit from equal access to broadband internet access service within the service area of a provider. Again, referencing a provider. So the court didn't see any sort of textual hook, certainly not a textual hook that would meet the Loper-Bright standard to justify regulating anyone other than broadband providers. The court had an interesting discussion where it articulated two other issues that were debated in the record, but didn't quite decide them. First, it talked about the debate about whether penalties would be available in the way that the FCC described, using the FCC's forfeiture authority and other authority that derives from the Communications Act. I would say the decision hinted around the idea that the court might have, or at least some of the judges might have agreed to with the argument that those penalties aren't available, at least in the disparate impact context, but it didn't quite come out and say so. The other issue that the court discussed but declined to reach was the arbitrary and capricious argument. But note, there's a footnote that says that the FCC didn't explain its departure from the inclusive community standard. The court said it didn't need to reach this issue because it was deciding the case based on these other broader issues. But I felt like that footnote kind of gave away where it would have landed had it reached that particular issue.
Thank you. Kind of maybe Dan, so Jen, Dan kind of mentioned the Eighth Circuit's application of Loper-Bright. Can you kind of go a little bit deeper into that and discuss how the Eighth Circuit applied Loper-Bright in its analysis of disparate impact?
It basically, so the reason that, you know, after Loper-Bright, there's no deference even on difficult questions to the agency. Instead, it's the court's job to figure it out. And so, you know, it came up sprinkled throughout, but it just basically focused its analysis on the traditional tools of statutory interpretation, the text, the statutory context. And it thought that under those tools, the FCC had exceeded its authority on both of the issues Dan mentioned. It said, I thought its kind of memorable line on this was like, the agency asked us for a trust us approach, which provides little comfort to regulated parties facing enormous non-compliance penalties. And so then it held that approach impermissible.
Thank you. And kind of going down the line here, a significant focus of the Eighth Circuit's discussion was analyzing the language of Section 6506 to determine whether Congress intended to include disparate impact liability. Obviously, as someone in Congress, this is something that's also very important to us as we draft statutes. Would love to get each panelist's kind of perspective of how the court got it right, got it wrong. Dan, I'll kind of start with you, then Chris, then Jen.
Sure. I think the court got it spot on. I can only go based on what the text of the statute says. I can't get in the head of every legislator who might have had a particular view on what the statute meant, but going off of the text and understanding that to reflect the will of Congress, I think the opinion is just spot on. It reasons from the wording of the statute and from case law based on because of or based on means in the discrimination context. The court looked to case law based on inclusive communities and other cases where disparate impact has been found, and rightly concluded that that sort of language wasn't available there, which presumably the drafters would have included if that's what they wanted to signal. If I don't have a lot to add to the opinion. If I could add anything, I think that there are also some structural arguments in favor of the court's approach, that this provision was tucked into the very end of a very long broadband section within an enormously long statute. The fact that this is Section 60506 says something, I think. And I think it's reasonable to conclude that if the court had wanted to go in more of a West Virginia major questions kind of direction, it's reasonable to conclude that Congress wouldn't have transformed how broadband and lots of entities that interact with broadband are regulated in the context of this small sort of at the end statute. I'll just also add that while the court rightly decided based on the law, as a regulatory attorney, I have trouble not mentioning policy. And there's a lot we all agree on. We all agree that we want everyone to have broadband. We want people of all backgrounds connected. I think this decision sets up the right path to get there by avoiding a lot of second guessing that would have been likely to deter deployment and investment, and instead lets what's been working keep working.
Thank you. Chris?
So I just to caveat what I'm about to say, I am not a lawyer. So I'm going to offer maybe something from a historical or academic perspective, but also as full disclosure, I served on the Communications Equity Diversity Council working group that researched digital discrimination for the commission. So I do have a bit of an investment in what I'm about to say. But I think that one of the things we really need to think about, I'll go back. I don't think the court got it right, but here's my explanation for this. I think one of the things that we really need to think about is, what exactly is broadband? Is it a market good like any other commodity, or is it something bigger? Is it a utility, or perhaps is it how the UN and EU have said it, a human right? The FCC obviously took the larger approach. Dan, I think you called it the maximal approach, the maximist approach, right? And you're absolutely right. They offered a wide regulatory framework that obviously the court struck down. But I think this is something that we really need to think through. And I'll remind everyone here that we don't have a working national broadband plan anymore. But I think we need to ask, why are we pushing so hard for digital equity and inclusion? Because, and the answer being that broadband is so much more than commerce, right? It's education, it's public safety, it's healthcare, it's the economy, it's agriculture, it's quality of life. It is quite literally our window into the world. So achieving universal service, therefore, should require stronger regulatory safeguards, because the market's going to do what the market's going to do, right? And the market has failed in so many of these areas. So these regulatory safeguards, I think, and what I found in my own research have been, you know, are really crucial to achieving those universal service goals. So I was disappointed to see how the court ruled, because I do think that the digital discrimination rules were a good step in that direction.
Thank you, Chris. Jen, any additional kind of thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, look, this was our case, so we were happy to win. Everyone's always happy for a win. I would say the two things that really jumped out to me when I looked at this provision were, number one, Congress has had three statutes interpreted to include disparate impact liability, all of which use that like otherwise adversely affect language, and it wasn't in this one. And I just think at some point, if Congress wants to do something, it should use the language that the court has held did it before. Like, novelty in legislation in terms of like text of legislation is not a good for like the law. It's just better to stick with what we understand has been interpreted particular ways. Everyone then understands what Congress is trying to communicate. And the second thing I would say is, it's really hard to imagine how a regime adopting disparate impact based on income level would even work. Like, that was something we highlighted on our briefs here. This would be the first disparate impact regime where a protected characteristic was income level, but like, it also applied to things like pricing, and every price change will have a disparate impact based on income, because, you know, those with lower incomes can less afford price increases and are going to benefit more from price decreases and coupons and stuff than those with a higher income. So every single price decision made is going to have a disparate impact on the basis of income level. And that just makes it so hard for businesses to operate. And I think it would also make it very hard for a court to even like try to grapple with that kind of claim. So those two features always like jumped out at me as like the big indicators that there wasn't disparate impact liability here, and we thought the court got it right in concluding it didn't.
Thank you, Jen. Another big point of contention that the chamber and others raised was, did the FCC have authority to regulate just broadband providers in this context, or other entities outside of broadband providers? The court concluded that it did not. Dan and then Chris, can you kind of walk through what does this mean for the broader implications on the FCC's kind of authority in this space? Dan, then Chris.
Sure. I think it's a good reminder to this agency and other agencies that they're meant to regulate who Congress told them to regulate. And particularly for an expert agency like the FCC to stay within its area of expertise, Congress has occasionally told the FCC specifically to regulate specific areas that it wouldn't typically regulate, things like certain kinds of devices or online video with respect to closed captioning in some contexts. But Congress has been pretty clear when it's done that. And historically, the FCC, even at high points of regulation, even when it had things like its utility style approach to net neutrality, it was focused on regulating the communication service provider there and not everyone else. The digital discrimination approach really would have transformed the FCC into almost like the Federal Trade Commission in kind of reaching across the economy. You could have interpreted it to regulate any one of us on this call who was advising somebody with respect to the compliance or the litigation in the digital discrimination proceeding. And that's kind of a sign it's gone a little too far, I think. And so I think this is a helpful kind of refocus for the agency.
Yeah, I'll agree totally with Dan here. I mean, one of the things that when you read the FCC order that is hard to imagine is how would the FCC regulate apartments, which was actually used as an example, right? Like, how are they going to tell apartment managers what to do? That's a difficult task indeed. But I think it also now puts pressure on Congress to rethink what should be in the FCC's orbit. Now, I'm not saying apartments should be in the FCC's orbit, but, you know, there's a lot of conversations right now in D.C. around rewriting or reopening the 1996 Telecommunications Act. Is this an invitation? Is this something that Congress should take up? Which is that, hey, if we really want all of these other entities to be in the FCC's orbit, you know, there's been talk of putting AI algorithms within there as well. That requires a rewriting of the Telecom Act. And if Congress is really serious about these things being included, then it's up to Congress to open that act up or rewrite the act, which is a major undertaking. But as it is now, you know, it just turned 30 a couple of months ago. I think it's really time for an overhaul. But, you know, to agree with Dan, I mean, I think that the courts made the right decision to limit the FCC's jurisdiction to what is actually in its jurisdiction. But this is an invitation for Congress to continue the larger conversation around the 96 Act.
Yes, that actually transitions well into kind of like what's next on this. Chris, we'll kind of stick with you. So even though the Eighth Circuit vacated the rule, the statutory requirement's still in the books, the FCC has to address it in some form or fashion. Kind of taking out your crystal ball, what do you kind of see as kind of the commission doing in this space, maybe Congress, as you discuss, and also at the state and local level? Then Chris, we'll start with you, then we'll go to Dan.
Yeah, I think, you know, the onus now is really going to fall to states. So obviously, like you said, Matt, the FCC is obligated by statute to address the issue. But we're also in a political climate, as Jennifer mentioned, that is quite hostile to DEI endeavors. Not only hostile, but actively punishes it, right? And the FCC has certainly been part of what I would consider to be this rather regressive political ecosystem. So my prediction is that, I mean, the FCC will have to do something, but they'll probably float a revised digital discrimination rule that will focus only on disparate treatment and intentional discrimination, right? In other words, I think they're going to do the bare minimum as required by Congress, but also as outlined in the courts. Let's not forget that as part of the Digital Equity Act, which the Trump administration also struck down, states were required to create statewide digital equity programs. So it'll be up to states if they want to pursue these agendas. So I think like in so much in broadband and telecom right now, the onus is going to fall onto states and localities to include, should they choose, any sort of digital discrimination mandates in their kind of digital equity plans or in their kind of, you know, statewide policies moving forward. But that is also fraught. And we saw this with attempts to regulate net neutrality at the state level as well. And it's also affordability if you look at, you know, what New York is doing with the Affordable Broadband Act. So it, you know, it's going to get messy. But I think, you know, what the FCC is going to do is they're just going to walk away from this. They're going to do a, you know, they said that we didn't see any intentional discrimination there. So they're going to say, we're going to ban intentional discrimination and we're going to walk away because that's exactly what we think Congress wanted us to do. And that's what the court said we should do. So I think we'll see a really minimalist approach from the FCC. And then we're going to see some states, I bet you dollars to donuts, step up and take on this mantle, and other states not.
Dan?
Sure. I agree that the FCC is going to have to eventually adopt rules. I certainly hope that they're ones that align with the statute and achieve what I think is Congress's vision as articulated in the statute of providing a backstop against intentional discrimination, which happily the FCC concluded the broadband market is free of, but it certainly needs to stay free of it. And rules preventing that can only help in that regard, even if the risk is low. As for states, as Chris suggested, they could look at a lot of different directions. My hope would be that they would look at things like permitting reform or eliminating requirements in certain states that keep certain carriers tied to outdated networks, things of that sort of change that would make it easier for the providers to do what everybody agrees is beneficial, which is investing in all sorts of communities to deploy broadband and faster speeds and create more competition that can continue to lower prices.
Thank you. And then kind of final question for Jen. So Minnesota, the decision kind of pursued kind of traditional statutory analysis. They looked at this in the context of inclusive communities. What does this kind of decision mean for other, you know, statutory regimes on discrimination and other types of other, you know, potential litigation on the FCC's authority?
So I think it's a cautionary tale for agencies that, you know, they're not getting the deference that they once did. So they need to be really careful about looking at their statutory authorities when they are making decisions. Obviously, there's a lot of doctrines about, you know, trying to serve the purposes that Congress set out, but it's all going to be viewed through the prism of, you know, what is the statutory text adopted that gives the FCC authority to act in the space or another agency to act in the space. And, you know, Chris makes good points about, like, clearly Congress was trying to do something in terms of expanding broadband deployment. Like, that there are so many indicators, but here maybe this was not in the suite of tools that the FCC could use. At least that's, you know, what the court concluded. And I think that this decision can also be read as a cautionary tale, in particular about disparate impact liability. So, you know, while the Supreme Court, you know, in inclusive communities, it found disparate impact liability, it adopted lots of guardrails and it seemed kind of hesitant about disparate impact. And the court has changed. It has moved since inclusive communities. You know, Justice Kennedy, who wrote that opinion, is no longer on the court. And the court hasn't found a disparate impact regime since. So it definitely has the feel in some ways of like the Sandoval line of cases. Like, the court was implying causes of action and then they say, oh, now we're not doing it anymore. We're out of the business. And that's kind of how it feels on disparate impact. So if Congress wants disparate impact liability, it's going to need to be clear. And it's going to need to put that in the statute. And both Congress and any agencies are going to need to think about making sure that any disparate impact regimes that they adopt comply with the constitutional guardrails as set forth by the Supreme Court in that inclusive communities decision. It doesn't mean disparate impact liability is gone. Congress could enact it. The Supreme Court has not held it to be unconstitutional, but they're going to need to really hew closely to those guardrails that the Supreme Court has identified.
Thank you, Jen, and thank you for everyone for these very insightful analysis and comments on the past, present, and future of this issue. Lily, I will turn it back to you.
Thanks, Matt. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. And I want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforum@fedsoc.org. As always, keep an eye out on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.